Welcome back to Ask the Compound, the show where we answer all the questions straight from you, the viewer. Our email here, askthecompoundshow@gmail.com. Excellent show for today. We're going to talk about how I personally automate my finances. We got a lot of questions about that. We're going to talk about my Tuesday arms and back workout. No, I'm just kidding. Why higher interest rates haven't crushed the stock market yet. How to prepare for large one-off capital gains tax hit if you sell a business. Tax strategies for dealing with required minimum distributions. And the pros and cons of Roth 401ks. Today's show is sponsored by Rocket Money. I'll be talking about them in my automation of finances. Rocket Money is that personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. They just told me this week, hey Ben, your annual Esquire subscription is coming up. I still get the physical magazine.
Wow.
Because I'm an old.
Wow. Yeah, that's like vintage. That's vintage stuff.
It's literally like $12 a month. I don't know how they make money. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saved memberships, and members have saved $740 a year when using the app's features. It's really nice. It's really easy. Stop placing money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/ATC. That's rocketmoney.com/ATC. Duncan, I got a question for you.
Okay.
I'm not trying to open up your trades to the world, but you this week said there was a company that got taken over. And you bought call options on the company on Friday, right? Or they expired on Friday, and on Monday the company got taken over. And my question for you is, so you missed out on a potential.
It's worse than that. I bought the calls like a couple months ago, and they happened to expire that Friday before they announced they were being taken over, and the stock soared the Monday after.
So it was a near miss. Like a near gain. You could have had a gain, or I sold this company after a 80% pop, and then it went on to grow 10,000% or whatever. Is that worse than an actual loss, or maybe the same? It's got to be pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, it hurts. The GameStop one I've talked about hurts worse, though. The GameStop one I was in, you know, I can't remember, but around like $5 or something, and I sold it like 2 weeks before the meme mania. And for a gain, I had a gain in it, but yeah, I missed out on a pretty.
So you followed the
pretty big gain.
You followed that guy into the stock. What was his name?
No, I actually didn't even know who he was. I just liked the stock, I guess.
You were doing funder. You liked the stock like him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But I think you could say that like a near miss, like you should have had a gain, has to be almost the same feeling as an actual loss.
Well, I think because there's no hope at that point, right? It's like my calls are gone. At least when you lose money in a stock, you're like, well, it could always come back. There's always like some hope there. Whereas, yeah, when you miss out on
it, might even be worse.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, when you miss out on big gains, yeah, it almost.
The good
hurts.
News is you keep Michael and I entertained with your stories of trading foibles.
Well, I'm happy to be here to entertain.
All right, let's do a question.
Okay, up first today we have Ben. In episode 100, while talking about your spreadsheets, you mentioned that the reason it doesn't take you a lot of time to do your finances is because you have it all automated. Can you speak on efficient ways, tools, and resources to automate your finances?
Good question. I mentioned that a lot of mine is pretty old school. I still get the physical magazines, and I also still use Excel spreadsheets for most of my spend tracking. I mean, I think the simplest one for most people is just automating all of your bills, right? So all my utilities are paid automatically. All 15 of my credit cards have automatic payment on them, pay off the total statement balance in full, right? Not the minimum payment. That's an easy one. Set up the auto pay right away. Mortgage payments automatic, car payments automatic, insurance, phones, cable, streamers, gym membership, all that stuff is automatically paid. I never have to think about it. I don't know if I write any checks anymore, really, which is kind of nice. So the biggest benefit there is, you know, no late fees, out of sight, out of mind. I also have mentioned this in the past. I treat saving and investing like it's auto pay, like it's a bill pay. So 401k right out of my paycheck. That's an easy one for most people, but I also automate my IRA contributions, my 529 contributions, brokerage account contributions, online savings account contributions. And I even have I have the general savings account, but I also have different sub accounts for, you know, property taxes and vacations and auto insurance and stuff. So that stuff just accumulates because I'm doing it on a monthly basis. Then within these various accounts, the predetermined asset allocations are set. So the money not only just goes, it doesn't go and sit there in cash. You have to think about it. It gets invested automatically into these different funds at this allocation. And so I think that helps to, you know, get rid of the allure of market timing. So cash doesn't become this gateway drug to investing mistakes. And I think the biggest one for me when it comes to investing is probably just have, I have a fairly simple portfolio. I don't make a lot of changes. I don't make a lot of sells. I mostly do contributions and buys. Doesn't mean I don't make any changes. I do at times, but they're just few and far between and I make sure they count. So I'm not analyzing 100 different companies every time I want to make a purchase. I know exactly what I'm going to put money in. So there's still some maintenance required. Of course, there's one-off purchases that might be outside of the budget. I do have to keep an eye on the spending levels, but that's pretty easy through some combination of credit card, online banking, and then Rocket Money always gives me like a weekly summation, which is pretty good.
Does Rocket Money scold you over how much you spend on clothing?
Not yet. I probably deserve a slap on the wrist, though. My wife thinks I have too many shoes. So I think as long as you can get rid of like the major headaches, there might be some minor. Like I peruse every time I get a credit card statement, I will kind of look at it like you're looking at, like when you look at your bill at the restaurant, right? You kind of look, yeah, is this okay? Sure. And so I kind of look through it to make sure nothing stands out. But I think you can probably get 90% of the way there to automating your finances. And then you have checks and balances along the way. I think that's the simple part. But you also have to like be able to regulate your spending if you're going to do it that way. Like, I put everything on my credit card, but you have to understand that's pretty easy to go overboard if you're not careful. I kind of have a good sense of what our spending levels are on a monthly basis and understand if we're going to go be over or above or maybe below even.
I think it's worth mentioning too how lucky we are to have commission-free trading now for this if you're trying to just automate your investing and every week put in a certain amount. Back in the day, I mean, back when I first got into investing, it was like 10 bucks a trade. So that immediately, for someone like a small timer like me, that immediately just took away any point of you really trying to
That's the great thing like is every brokerage account there is now will have these tools for you. Automatic rebalancing, automatic contributions, automatic investing, automatic reinvestment of dividends. All that stuff can be done automatically these days. It makes it very easy to not tinker. And I think that's the beauty of it is just keeping things simple. And like I'm doing the heavy lifting ahead of time, so I don't have to do it later. So I think most of these places, depending on who you use, the tools are there if you set them up in advance. That's the idea. It's just I'm making good decisions ahead of time, so I don't have to think about it every time something comes in. Or did I do this month? Or, oh no, I forgot. There's none of that.
Right.
Makes your life easier.
For sure.
All right. Next question.
Hey, and that one was from Jay. Up next, we have a question from Jeff. I don't work in finance, but I'm an engineer, so I know enough math to get me into trouble. All else equal, a higher discount rate should mean a lower present value of future cash flows. I know all is not always equal, but with rates rising again and the prospect of higher for longer now firmly on the table, shouldn't that be a headwind for stocks? What am I missing here?
I don't want to throw shade at Jeff here, but the stereotype is engineers and doctors are usually the worst investors. And
because they know enough to get themselves into trouble.
Because they're smart. Yeah. And sometimes when you're really smart and successful in one field, it doesn't always translate. And a lot of people think, well, geez, I went to school for a very long time. I'm intelligent. I should be able to do this. It's kind of like rich hedge fund managers who try to manage sports teams, right? And they buy a sports team and then they fail miserably. Success in one area of life doesn't necessarily translate. I'm not saying all engineers and doctors, but that is a stereotype and it's kind of true. Finance theory does dictate that the present value of an asset is a future value of cash flow streams discounted back at some reasonable rate. So Duncan, it's PV equals CF over 1 plus R to the T. R is the interest rate. CF is the cash flows. T is time.
Yep. So that's right.
You got it. Yep. All else equal, raise the R in the denominator and the output should go down, right? The problem is there is a huge difference between theory and reality when it comes to finance. And as Jeff mentioned in the question, all is rarely ever equal. So Daniel, give me a chart on here of rates. It is true, after rising at a fast clip last fall, interest rates dipped. Now they're rising again. We got the 2-year at, 5% again. The 10-year is approaching 4.7. 30-year bonds are approaching 4.8, 4.9%. The spread of the short and long end is compressing. So when long rates rise, you would think this should be bad for the stock market because the stock market is a long duration asset. Again, in theory, this makes sense, but the history of the stock market performance doesn't really bear that out. In fact, the S&P 500 has done just fine when rates have risen in the past. Daniel, do the next table for me. I created this pre-pandemic, a lot of numbers on here. I'm just going to say what this is. Every time the 10-year treasury since 1950 has risen 1%, what happens to the stock market during that time? Most of the time it's up. The annualized average return during those periods when rates were rising, 1% or more, has been 11%, which is basically the long-term average of the stock market. Dan, you can do a chart off for me. And there was only two times when stocks actually fell, and they fell minimal amounts, like 1% or 2%. So when rates have risen in the past, it hasn't actually been a headwind for the stock market. Now, that's just rising rates, okay? But what about higher levels of rates, right? We're coming from very low levels to high levels. The relationship between interest rates and stock market performance is actually murky. There's not like a one-to-one. Like, if rates are low, returns are going to be good. And rates are really high, returns are bad. So, Daniel, one more time, chart on here. I looked at the 1, 3, and 5-year forward returns for the S&P 500 when the 10-year is at different levels. And I looked at lower than 2%, 2 to 3%, 3 to 4, all the way up to higher than 8%. And you can see the best returns have tended to come at lower than 2%, which makes sense. But I'm not sure it's exactly a correlation thing, because the only times this has happened was the great financial crisis aftermath and the COVID crash. And so the 2% rates are lower. You could say, I'm just going to wait till rates at 2% are lower, and that's the only time I'm going to invest. It's only happened like 6% of the time or something. It's kind of funny, though, that the two worst times to be an investor for interest rates were 3 to 4% or 7 to 8%. But then if you go above 8%, returns have actually been okay. And I think the problem here is just, we probably don't have enough time of history to actually look at this. If you look at this 4 to 6% range, which we're at now, returns have actually been pretty good. Not bad. All right, you can do chart off, Daniel. And I think the reason for that is because the average 10 years since 1950, Duncan, what's your guess? Average 10-year yield since 1950?
7%.
It's a little over 5%, 5.5%-ish. So that 5 to 6% range, or 4 to 5%, it's actually kind of normal. So the point is, there's really no rhyme or reason to the relationship between interest rate levels and forward stock market returns. Sometimes it's done pretty well with really high rates. Sometimes it's done poorly. Sometimes it's done pretty well with low rates. Sometimes it's done poorly. The question is, why are rates rising in the first place? That's the thing that matters. That's the context. So in the 70s, higher rates were a headwind to stocks because inflation was out of control and the economy was experiencing stagflation. So the biggest upside surprise this time around is just that higher for longer meant economic growth is higher for longer too. It's not just inflation, its growth has remained higher. Came in a little soft today, but at the end of last year, growth was accelerating. So the Fed hasn't had to cut rates yet because the economy remains relatively strong. And I think that's what people forget. So when you combine higher economic growth with pricing power by corporations, they keep raising the prices, we keep spending money, right? We complain about it, but we keep spending money. And then you have inflation that gives us our next chart. Daniel, chart on here. Higher earnings. Look at how much higher earnings are now than they were before the pandemic. And we don't adjust these for inflation because we don't want to. It looks better nominally. And you can see this is forward return. This is 12-month forward EPS for the S&P 500. The stock market likes higher earnings. So one of the reasons I think that we haven't had this big tumble in stocks from when rates went from 0 to 5%, we obviously had a bear market, but now that rates have stayed higher, it's not like the stock market is freaking out. Part of the reason is because it's led to higher earnings. You can do chart off, Daniel. Now, it doesn't always work out like this, and I don't know how long the current situation will last. Maybe the situation is over now that we're in a little mini correction here, but the point is you can't simply examine one variable in isolation. Like, economic and market data require context. You can't just look at a level and say, okay, this is bad or this is good. Context is required.
So not to bait you into saying something controversial, but is the yield curve indicator irrelevant these days? Is it still useful?
You think I want to walk into a bear trap? Well, I mean, it's been inverted for 2 years now. I think we've gone about as long as it's ever been inverted before.
Because based on what you were just showing, I mean, they're still inverted, right?
I think the point is there's an exception to every rule. Even if the yield curve makes sense in theory, there's always going to be an exception to the rule. And you, any one of these rules of thumb that you have for finance, you can poke holes in them, or something that used to work in the past doesn't work again in the future. I think that's the part where you can't have this line of thinking where I know exactly what's going to happen in the stock market because this happened in the past. That doesn't work.
Right. We love Next Campbell question. Harvey. So I'm just asking.
Yes. That. It was bound to miss at some point.
Yeah. You can't have 100% success.
Yes.
Okay. Unless you're Max Verstappen in F1, and then it seems to be pretty much.
Are people still pretending to like F1? Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm kidding.
Oh, man. Right. Yes. For the most part, I think so. Okay. Up next, we have a question from David.
See, that was my controversial statement there, Duncan.
Yeah, no, for sure. Okay, so David writes, I'm in the early stages of selling my business and would love to minimize my tax liability as much as possible. A little context. It's a catering company structured as an LLP in New York, which we've had for 15 years. It's looking like we'll sell for around $2 million. It's me and one 50-50 partner. This price doesn't include any real estate, just assets, value of lease, and intangibles such as customer base. Not sure if there's something we should be doing before or after to try to take home as much of the sales price as possible, but would love to hear if you have any suggestions. Expecting the worst, but hoping for the best in this situation, considering we're in New York.
All right. Let's bring on a tax expert who's worked with people in New York before.
Hey, Bill.
Bill number two.
What's up, guys?
Bill Arzeroni. And Bill, you just finished up tax season. You've been working like crazy, I'm sure. Anything you'd like to just vent or have a big sigh of relief? How are we feeling?
Speaking of F1, I've missed like the first six races because of tax season, so I got some catching up to do. Duncan got me up to speed today, though.
Do all the tax people kind of congregate at the bar after it's done and just bitch and moan to each other? Is that what happens?
If they're like me, they don't want to see anybody. They just want to go take a walk.
Okay. There we go. Okay, so David has a pretty successful catering business here. If he's going to sell it for $2 million in New York. Now, I think we could probably give the same, you can correct me if I'm wrong, similar advice to someone who has a big capital gains tax hit because of a stock that they own that has a low basis or a house that they're selling, whatever. If you have a big capital gain tax hit coming, what can you do to prepare in advance, or is it already too late?
Yeah, so there are some subtle differences with business sales versus securities, crypto, real estate. But I want to reframe this. You know, Dave finished his question basically expecting the worst. And I want to reframe and remind Dave.
Well, which is what most people do in taxes, right?
He's going to, it sounds like he's going to net $1 million. So whatever Dave started this company with 15 years ago, probably wasn't $1 million. So I think he did okay on this deal. The one maybe low-hanging fruit is take a look at your inventory of assets, whether that is securities or crypto or anything you own. If anything is underwater, currently at a less than what you purchased it for, sell it, capture a capital loss, and that capital loss can offset the gain on the business.
Right. So if he followed Duncan into Oatly call options, get rid of him.
Yes. He can potentially
lock in those losses.
All of this capital gain.
I own shares, not options.
Sorry. But yeah, that's the point. But other than that, I mean, what else is there to do?
Specific to business sales, you can structure it where instead of selling one business, you're chopping up that business into little assets, and certain assets are taxed at different rates. So he brought up his customer base. That's considered an intangible asset. That could be taxed at long-term capital gain rates versus ordinary income rates, which could be higher if he's selling a vehicle as part of this sale. So structuring that, now the buyer has to agree to that structure, and the buyer has the opposite incentive, so it kind of nets even. The other consideration is if you're comfortable with the buyer, you could spread out the capital gain over a series of years via an installment sale. So instead of taking all the proceeds in year one, you spread it out evenly over a period of time and you recognize an equal amount of capital gain per year that you receive the cash.
Now, do you think David should be talking to a financial planner, tax consultant before this happens just to get a good idea of what's going to happen here just so he doesn't miss anything?
Almost certainly. This is complex stuff. Business sales are not simple. And planning ahead, you know, if the sale is imminent, there's 8 months left in the year to help offset that. So time is of the essence.
Yeah. But as you pointed out, David kind of won the game here. Like, good for him. He regardless of the taxes he's paying, he built this business over a decade and a half and he's selling it for a lot of money. That's impressive.
Huge one. Well done.
All right. Next question.
Okay. Up next, we have a question from Joe. My wife and I are in our early 70s and retired with a guaranteed USG pension. Is that U.S. government?
Yeah, that's okay. What I'm taking that as.
We have no debt and are in a good place financially. The problem is that in 2 years, we'll have $2 million in tax-deferred investments that will be subject to required minimum distribution. I'm trying to figure out an offset. Roth conversions are probably limited at this point, given the approaching 73rd birthday. Our paid-off house is one of the oldest on the block after a generation of homes being remodeled, renovated, and replaced. Would it make sense from an investing standpoint to pull $500,000 from the house, do a radical renovation or new build, and then use the RMD to repay the mortgage and gain a healthy mortgage interest deduction to offset the increased income? Are there any other ways to blunt the RMD jackhammer? This sounds a lot like financial chess to me, I got to be honest.
This is another one of someone who's won the game and they're trying to figure out, okay, what do I now do to, you know, offset the tax man? Are there any, maybe first you can explain how the required minimum distributions work for those who are unfamiliar, and then we'll get into the tax side of things.
Yeah, so RMDs, required minimum distributions, currently they start at age 73. If you turn 73 in the year 2024, you have to take an RMD either by the end of the year or by next April 1st. The RMD is a percentage of your qualified retirement assets.
Right, so if you have a 401k or an IRA, a percentage of those assets has to come out each year depending on some certain schedule.
Correct.
And is this just to make sure that the government can collect taxes?
Yeah, think about what Joe accomplished here. And I wanted to reframe this. Ben, you beat me to it. Joe won the game here. He deferred income and deferred tax his whole career. And now the government wants their piece before, you know, hopefully
Joe. Right. If this isn't a taxable account, he wouldn't have $2 million.
That's right. That's right. He would have paid tax on dividends, interest, capital gains the whole time. He's avoided that tax. And now everybody wants their cut of it. To answer Joe's question about the home loan, I don't love it. It kind of depends on Joe's other deductions. Right now, assuming Joe here is married, his standard deduction is about $30,000. He's going to get that whether he has an interest on his house or not. To start seeing a tax deduction, the interest on the house would need to be like $20,000 a year or more just to start seeing a tax deduction. So I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze here. Take a loan against the house.
Well, that's true. And if you're paying down the loan with RMDs, then the interest tax deduction is going to go down every year too.
Correct. Yeah. And so, you know, for Joe, maybe just take this RMD that you don't want and do the construction with the proceeds, right? If you have a $2 million IRA, that first year RMD is going to be something like $60,000 or $70,000, and just start your home projects from there.
Right. We all know that the projects take longer than you think. You're going to cost more than you think. So yeah, spread it out a little bit, put in a pool for the grandkids in the backyard. So you're right that taking out that loan is not going to help all that much it's not going to move the needle very much in terms of taxes.
No, the one thing that could move the needle, and we don't have enough context from Joe, but if Joe is charitably inclined over the age of 70 and a half, he can take money direct from his IRA and give it to charity. And that money will never be taxable. So up to $100,000 a year, $105,000 now, he can give direct to charity from that IRA. So if he has a $70,000 RMD and he doesn't want to pay tax on it, he could give it direct to charity. Nobody pays tax on it.
Oh, that's a good idea. I like it. But the other thing is that like at some point, it's hard to offset these and you're just going to have to eat the taxes.
Well, offsetting tax means giving up something else. If Joe has a $70,000 RMD and he gives it all to charity, that's super generous, but Joe's not going to touch that $70,000. After tax, that $70,000 is still worth 40 or 50. So it's either keep 40 or give away 70.
Right. Yeah. As much as you can do, but at a certain point, you're just going to have to eat the taxes, unfortunately.
Yeah. Pay a tax. Yeah. Support your government bridges and other construction projects.
All right. One more question.
All right. Last but not least, we have a question from Damien. My wife and I are blessed to have two great jobs in a low cost of living state. While we travel and spoil our daughter, at the end of the day, we still have a lot left over for investing.
Not the brag of the day here.
Right. We're in the 35% marginal tax bracket and currently max out our traditional 401ks. We also contribute to IRAs, hello back to a Roth, and taxable brokerage accounts. Assuming we could take the tax hit and max out a Roth 401k and that we're already investing the difference in our taxable accounts, would it be better to pay the taxes now or defer them for the future? Would this just be a case of psychic income? I get it. We're doing more than fine. Just curious about the best way to think about our family's future.
All right, Bill. So if they're maxing out their 401k, that's what, $23,000 in 2024?
That's right.
So assuming most people who are doing the traditional versus Roth thing and aren't spreadsheet warriors like we probably have in the chat here, most people don't put money in a traditional 401k or IRA and then save the tax difference, right? That's what someone would do in theory, but not in reality. So do you actually look at having a Roth 401k as like being able to save more money in some ways? Or am I looking at it the wrong way?
I do. I see Bill Sweet in the chat here, and Bill and I kind of have a long running joke that people just learn to live on what's in their bank account. So if you're contributing to the 401k and you're doing it in a Roth account, which is after tax, you're just getting a direct deposit every 2 weeks and you're learning to live on that. So there's this psychic thing that happens where even though it might not make the most sense long-term, dollars and cents, you might save more. And nobody's ever going to be mad in their 70s that they have all tax-free money in their Roth account. Nobody's right. ever going to be upset about
this,
that.
This is getting back to the last question. He probably wishes he had more in Roth.
Right, exactly.
At that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, at 35%, it's more likely than not that that Damian's future tax rate is lower than his current tax rate. So a perfect spreadsheet on paper, the pre-tax amount probably makes more sense. Damian, you could also spread it out. You could do some pre-tax and some Roth. It's not all or nothing. But there's so many variables that go into this. There's current tax rate, future tax rate, growth rates, and these are all unknowns. So I kind of like splitting the difference here.
Yeah, but I guess my favorite part about having the Roth and the match from the company still goes in traditional, right? Which seems bizarre to me.
Right. I don't. There's an option starting. The custodian plans haven't implemented this, but employees can now choose to have a Roth contribution on their behalf from the employer.
Okay. But I think the best part about having the Roth is thinking through these other questions where people are trying to figure out lowering their tax in retirement. It's just simpler. Like, it's fewer decisions you have to make in the future, regardless of what's happening. I actually do think for a lot of young people, the traditional can make sense and it saves you on your taxes, but are you actually going to apply those tax savings to your investment accounts? And most people probably won't, right? If they get a refund from the government, they're going to do something else with that money. Personally, I think the first big tax return I ever got when I first started working, I'm pretty sure I invested the money. I put it in my brokerage account. But most people probably aren't going to do that, right?
Accurate. It's even for us in this world that we live in, Ben, we're not machines. We're not robots.
We bucket that money differently.
We're not robots yet.
No. Yeah, good point. Thank you.
But yeah, we bucket that money differently. So that's one of the reasons that I think, and to your point, sounds like they're saving in taxable accounts and IRAs and they're doing the backdoor Roth. They have some tax diversification already, but I think that's the best part about the Roth is just that it makes your life in the future. Future you is going to thank you for having those Roth dollars where you don't have to think about it very much in terms of, should I take them out? Should I not? It's easier.
Yeah, Ben, one other nugget for Damian. Check your employer plans. If there's a mega backdoor Roth option in the 401k, that would allow you to get the best of both worlds. You could do the pre-tax up to the annual $23,000 limit, and then you could do basically a backdoor Roth inside of that 401k up to like $69,000 this year. Some plans offer it, some plans don't, but it could be a game changer for our guy Damian, who's a pretty diligent saver.
Speaking of the robot stuff, when is the AI going to make it easy to just push a button and do the backdoor Roth for me?
If AI is doing that, AI is doing tax returns and I'm out of a job. So let's okay. chill with that.
Yeah. All right. That's probably not going to happen. TurboTax didn't put you out of a job. You should be fine.
Yeah, good point.
Okay. All right. Bill, thanks for helping out today. Always appreciate some tax advice. It is so many people, we get so many questions on tax because as we see from these questions, people hate paying taxes.
Right.
Right.
But as someone said on Twitter last week that tagged us, they said the easiest way to not pay taxes is to be broke, so.
Yes. Or lose money. The whole right. point here is that if you've got a huge capital gains tax, you've won the game. You did something right.
Right.
Email us, askthecompoundshow@gmail.com. No compounded friends tomorrow, right? Everyone's on vacation.
Yep. Vacation week.
Josh sent us a Slack this week and said that Michael and I are ahead of the game because all the 18-year-olds there are wearing Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah.
See, I'm a trendsetter as a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
How about that?
Trendsetter. And I mean, do you have any workout tips? For real, that was one of the main comments on TCAF last week. Everyone was seeing you in this new light. They were asking, what does Ben do?
Start lifting weights when you're 16 like I did. It plays compound interest to start early.
Cool.
Right?
Cool.
And I never even got a thank you for giving you that new hat.
Oh, yeah. I finally got my Bird Dogs hat. Everyone that's been watching for a while, Ben has promised this hat for many months, and he finally brought it on his way to a New York trip. So yeah, thanks. Right. Thanks for that.
Remember, email us, give us a comment, question, review, all that stuff. askthecompoundshow@gmail.com is our email. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Ask the Compound. All opinions expressed by Ben Carlson, Duncan Hill, and any of their guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.